Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with David Kim. The Philadelphia Orchestra is celebrating his 10th anniversary as its concertmaster in a series of performances this week. As Pennsylvania Ballet prepares to open its 45th season, Susan Lewis looks at the company's summer excursion to a prolific training ground for new dancers in rural Pennsylvania. David Patrick Stearns profiles Andras Schiff and his current Beethoven Sonata Odyssey. And Jason Pfeiffer explores sacred harp singing, a resurgent a cappella tradition that dates back to the early 1800s. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Even before he was born, David Kim's parents wanted their child to be a world-class violinist. They envisioned him as an acclaimed soloist on the stages of the world's great concert halls, and Kim himself for many years pursued this dream. Ultimately, David Kim did realize his parents' fantasy, but not in the way they had expected. He has, for the past 10 years, been concertmaster of the Philadelphia Orchestra, a role which sometimes puts him center stage as soloist, as in a series of concerts this week. When we met, he first told me how his parents' hopes and dreams had become his own, and how that dream had changed over time.
My parents had this dream that I would be a concert soloist from probably when I was still in the womb. And from the age of 3, when they first put a violin in my hands, that was kind of the goal. And so the mindset in my family, I'm an only child, was always kind of almost a foregone conclusion. Like, David is going to train his whole life, and then he's going to be a big, famous soloist. And that was there was no two ways about it. There was no question of, well, let's see if he has the talent by age 10 or 11, or let's see if he has a tin ear, or there was no question.
For a lot of life-changing events, we like to think of there being an epiphany. Most of the time, it's a gradual change. Which was it for you when you decided that this wasn't going to happen, that your path lay in another direction?
It was certainly an epiphany. I was not seeing the writing on the wall for many years. And by the time I had my little epiphany, I was kind of in my early 30s. And that is way too late. I should have known way before then that the solo career was not going to happen. But as I say, it was a part of me. It was such a determined goal for my family, for me, my teachers, everybody. Spoke as though it were a foregone conclusion, so I never could really get myself to look in the mirror, and say, you know what, this is not going to happen. And so finally, when I decided in my early 30s that I was going to pursue a concertmaster position, I remember my wife and I many, many times would sit around. She's not a musician, but she kind of learned a little bit about the music business, and we would sit around the kitchen table and say, okay, well, what about National Symphony in Washington, D.C.? And I would say, oh, well, that's possible. I mean, that would be a stretch, but what about Detroit? Yeah, I think I might be able to do that, maybe a few years. And then she would say, well, what about Philadelphia? Are you kidding? Honestly, I would always say that is way beyond my abilities. And so when somehow it did happen, I really did consider it a real gift from God.
How has your role changed over 10 years, do you think? Because clearly you have grown as an artist. You have grown in stature within the orchestra. Have you changed?
Absolutely. I've changed a lot in 10 years. I feel like the change never stops happening. I remember several years ago, during a particularly difficult time for me, I was not adjusting well to the job, and I called up my predecessor, Norman Carroll, who was in this position for 30 years. And I had lunch with him in Wynwood, and I just looked across the table and I said, when do you start feeling comfortable and like you've kind of arrived? And he put down his napkin and fork and he looked over at me and he said, never. He said, when you retire, you'll feel comfortable. And he said, you know, I was here for 30 years and I never got comfortable in the job, and now I'm retired and finally I understand that it never is easy. It's never smooth, and that's just, it comes with the territory. And he's absolutely right. Entering this hall every day, as I walk down 15th Street from Suburban Train Station, I feel butterflies in my stomach every day, before every rehearsal, before every concert. And I think that's a good thing. And I think humility and an attitude each day, that each day is a new challenge, and that I do occupy a very important position in the orchestra, and yet my job is not to perform, but to serve. And there are many facets to serving. And so that is what I strive to do each day.
Philadelphia Orchestra Concertmaster David Kim. This evening, the orchestra continues its celebration of a decade of his role as concertmaster with the final in a three-concert series featuring works by Schumann and Faye, with David Kim as soloist on Chausson's Poème for Violin and Orchestra and Ravel's Tzigane for Violin and Orchestra.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Next week, Pennsylvania Ballet opens its 45th season. The six programs range from the traditional to the contemporary, from Balanchine's Nutcracker to two world premieres. Away from its main stage, the company's activities are also expanding. In August, the company launched a new two-week summer program at one of the hottest ballet training grounds in the country. Not in New York, San Francisco, or any other big city, but at an inauspicious school in the middle of farmland in the small town of Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at the continuing evolution of Pennsylvania Ballet as it reaches back to old friends and forward to a new generation of dancers at the Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet.
Even with good directions, you can be not quite sure you're in the right place. The low, boxy building of the Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet is tucked toward the back of a warehouse complex off a side road. Only its deep red awning along the parking lot and the sounds of music wafting through the windows give it away. Well, that and the traffic of lithe young bodies back and forth through the front doors. Inside, a large hallway with potted plants and painted columns on the walls is a gathering place for leotard-clad dancers who range in age from 7 or 8 to about 21.
The hallway's actually quiet now. There are usually people everywhere. You can't even walk through.
Alexis Milne is 11.
What's everybody doing in the hallway?
They're getting their points on and getting ready to go for class.
Alexis is one of about 30 students here for a two-week summer program called Beyond Technique. Pennsylvania Ballet founder Barbara Weisberger serves as the program's artistic advisor. Her relationship with the Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet goes back to its early days, when its founder held classes in a barn.
I was Marcia Dale Weary's first guest teacher, probably in 57 or 58, when she was just moving into the barn. This is rather recent, this gorgeous facility we're in now. And there were about 15 perfect little children waiting for me in fifth position.
It was, says Weisberger, a time of tremendous growth in American ballet. Starting with the 1934 founding of the School of American Ballet and subsequent 1948 birth of the New York City Ballet, legendary master George Balanchine was nurturing an art form, the seeds of which would spread and take root beyond the big city.
Balanchine realized that more dancers were being produced and no place for them to perform, just a very few places. I mean, what we know now came out of the proliferation of companies, sort of simultaneous combustion all through the country with regional ballet and interest in its development, mostly from teachers who sort of ended up where they began or their hometowns and began teaching in separate places.
Weisberger, who had started study with Balanchine when she was 8 years old as his first child student, had an itch to create a ballet company in Philadelphia. She started a school in 1962. Balanchine's interest and support led to a $45,000 grant and the formation of a company whose first performance was in 1963 on a Paoli farm owned by the then president of the board. Weisberger says it was, in a way, a test to see if Philadelphia wanted a ballet company. They were hoping to get 250 people.
To make a long story short, we had over 900 people, and they were sitting in the knolls of trees, and the 250 seats were used up very quickly, and they were just around, and it was a great moment.
In the last 45 years, the numbers have grown, with the ballet now claiming an annual audience of over 100,000. It presents a full season at home and also tours. What it does not currently have is its own school. 7 years ago, artistic director Roy Kaiser enlisted longtime company dancer William DeGregory to direct Pennsylvania Ballet II, a new 8-to-10-member pre-professional training corps for the ballet. As we sit talking at a picnic table outside the Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet, DeGregory says the mission of Pennsylvania Ballet II is twofold.
One is to train younger dancers with a little more experience, let them do things they would never do if they've gone into a company for the first year. And the second is to educate young students, like in their backgrounds, go to the schools and to establish education of our art form.
Education is an integral part of Pennsylvania Ballet's long-range plans, and artistic director Roy Kaiser says he jumped at this summer's partnership between Pennsylvania Ballet and Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet.
Because I respect immensely the work that Marcia has done here. I've had many of her dancers that she's trained come work with my company. She has dancers in virtually every major company around the world. And it just seemed like a natural fit, a natural collaboration.
And so amidst the sounds of birds and crickets, the 2-week summer workshop Beyond Technique was born. The students include 7 members of Pennsylvania Ballet II, students of Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet, and others, both local and from around the country. William DeGregory says as fundamental and important as technique is to classical dance, the company looks for dancers who are more than perfect technicians.
We want to find those special personalities and dancers who love to dance. It's not just about the steps. It's the emotion, it's the feeling that you put in those steps.
How do you teach a young dancer to strike that perfect balance between technical excellence and personal expression? Roy Kaiser says one way is to bring in someone like Pennsylvania Ballet's resident choreographer.
Matthew Neenan is creating new work for them. That's something that doesn't happen typically for students. It's something that typically dancers would experience once they're in a company for the first time.
Just kind of giving them a little insight of what it's like to create a piece, the creative process, and the importance of that, and also the importance of experimentation, letting the dancers know, especially at a young age, that they're very influential to a choreographer. It's not just me coming in and giving you steps. There's a camaraderie that's very important.
Good. I'll try it. You want to hear it first?
This summer's program also included work with guest artists contrasting the styles of Balanchine and Paul Taylor, and exploration of dance from a historical perspective with a dance critic from the Wall Street Journal. All of this in an environment filled with tradition and expectation. One need only look up at the photographs of former students on the wall of the central hallway.
She's doing a grand jeté. It's where you run and you leap into a split in the air. She's really good. That's a really good grand jeté because both of her feet are turned out perfectly.
Alexis Milne is part of that next generation of dancers, schooled and nurtured by those who love the art form and carry it forward, whether in a big city studio or in the rural countryside of Pennsylvania.
WRTI, Susan Lewis. Pennsylvania Ballet opens its new season on Wednesday at the Academy of Music with a program entitled Balanchine and Beyond. Hungarian pianist Andrew Schiff plays in Philadelphia nearly every season in any number of guises: chamber musician, concerto soloist, and solo recitalist, which is how he's being heard on Friday, October 31st in one of the biggest projects of his 30-year career. He's playing all 32 of Beethoven's piano sonatas. Philadelphia won't be hearing all of them, however, but a healthy slice of the mid-period sonatas, including the Appassionata and Les Adieux at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theater, presented by the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns talked with Schiff about life with Beethoven and what could possibly come after that.
When Andras Schiff takes on a particular composer, I envision them meeting in some comfortable parlor. The pianist pulls up a chair, the composer has a nice tall drink, one with a slight kick, and they discover over the course of conversation that they have so much more in common than they initially thought. Tchaikovsky discovers he doesn't need to sound heroic in order to be heroic. Chopin hasn't quite so much to be sad about. And the notoriously cantankerous Beethoven maybe doesn't need anger management therapy. Though still very much themselves, Schiff makes them speak more clearly than ever. Their clothes may not be any more stylish, but at least they're nicely pressed, and the acne is all gone. Schiff was entertained by this characterization, but had a different way of describing his process, in which he is a little more subservient to the music.
It's not slavery, but there are certain rules. A work has its framework, and as a performer, you are not allowed to go outside of that frame. Now, a lot of people will disagree with that, but I do believe in that. Horowitz always went outside of that frame, and he was a great, great pianist. If it suited his personality, it was wonderful. But I was much more influenced in my aesthetics of music by somebody like Rudolf Serkin.
The cornerstone of Schiff's whole approach has long been the music of J.S. Bach, a curious career move for anybody, and artistically speaking, not what you'd expect from a pianist who came out of the tempestuous Hungarian tradition. Schiff has neither been as imposing as his countrymen, like Annie Fischer or Béla Bartók, nor as brainy and idiosyncratic as that other Bach specialist, Glenn Gould. Beethoven's sonatas weren't a natural fit for Schiff. They're impulsive, experimental, and wildly unstandardized pieces that come in 2, 3, 4 movements. However, Schiff's background in Bach came to the rescue during some of the most difficult passages of Beethoven, such as the fugal portions in this final movement of the Hammerklavier Sonata.
Maybe it's my perversion. I love pieces like that. You know, I've played Bach fugues that are musically and compositionally even more difficult. So, since my childhood, I always loved polyphony and counterpoint, and I love playing fugues. In the Hammerklavier, it's a struggle with the impossible.
Yet Schiff was unhappy with his Beethoven performances for many years.
The Appassionata is something that I played very young because my teacher in Budapest, Professor Kadosha, he loved Beethoven above all composers. So he's always, you have to play more Beethoven. And then I learned this Appassionata and I was terribly unhappy with the way I played it. But this was in my teens. And it took me many, many, not years, but decades.
It's easy to think that he's one of those perfectionists who is better than he thinks. However, recorded evidence shows fascinating differences between Schiff's performances of the Appassionata Sonata between 1996 and 2006. The tempos are about the same. But passages that seem like functional, if beautiful, ascending and descending scales in the earlier recording became something much more packed with meaning in the later one. As if the composer was opening a door into something that was beyond conception or description with bewilderment and amazement. Because Schiff tends to approach a composer's work in discrete periods, Bach for several years, then Schubert for a few, and now Beethoven, the pianist has long touched off eager speculation on how his contained, almost miniaturist art might be applied to bigger-boned composers. In fact, Schiff's fellow musicians are curious enough to even stand outside the pianist's practice room to hear what he's up to. One of them, Philadelphia Orchestra longtime violinist David Booth, says that some of the best concerts he ever played have been with Schiff.
It's funny, when he was here working, playing the Bach, he was here practicing every day, and I listened to him practice for quite a while. He was working on the Chopin Third Sonata. It was very beautiful. I mean, he's such, the musicianship, I think he's a guy that can, you know, bring insight to almost any style, and both style of playing and style of composer. I mean, to me, he's one of the absolute greatest pianists around.
When Schiff takes a 6-month sabbatical next year, he'll be learning Debussy and going to all the Shakespeare plays that he normally doesn't have time for when at home in London. But as wide as his still growing repertoire is, there are certain composers he knows he will never play.
I hope I am self-critical enough to say that this is not for me. I cannot do this well, and others can do it much better. You know, like, yes, Liszt is to me a problem because I was brought up in Hungary, and it was always like a Liszt cult there. But it's not Liszt's fault that his music is often played very badly by very brainless pianists who just play loud and fast.
Even if he did decide to play Liszt, there's one place where his day begins without fail.
I do play Bach every day, and that's already a very good way to start the day.
That report was by the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. He writes about Andras Schiff in tomorrow's paper. Schiff performs Beethoven sonatas in a Philadelphia Chamber Music Society concert at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theater on Friday. In recent years, the tradition of sacred harp music has enjoyed renewed interest throughout the country. Regular sacred harp meetings are held in over 30 states, including all-day gatherings, week-long camps, and national conventions. The music doesn't involve a harp of any kind, but rather features a cappella singing in four-part harmony. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the singing style has been around for centuries, and today regularly brings together diverse groups of singers.
On the fourth Thursday of each month, a group of about 30 or 40 people set up dozens of chairs into a square formation and cram into a small building called the A Space, just off of Baltimore Avenue in West Philadelphia. They gather to sing shape note music, also commonly referred to as sacred harp music, a nod to a popular songbook of the same name used by most singers. The book was first published in 1844, but the shape note system associated with sacred harp was invented around 1800. It's a style that was developed so that untrained singers could sight read music without having to understand key signatures. The music is written with shaped notes, triangles, ovals, squares, and diamonds, each notating the intervals from the key pitch. Fascinating as the mechanics of this four-shape note system might be, Elizabeth Stokes, the organizer of the monthly West Philadelphia singings, views something else as the primary attraction to sacred harp singing.
Pretty much the essence of what's really special about it is that it's participatory. We're not singing for an audience, we're singing for each other.
This is demonstrated in the arrangement of the singers. Divided into four groups, treble, alto, tenor, and bass, they sit in what's called a hollow square, with a voice part on each side of the square, all facing each other. There's no section for an audience, and there's no one conductor. The singers take turns selecting songs and leading them. While shape note music originated in colonial New England, it gained great popularity in the South and the western frontier of the country during the early 1800s. Over time, the sacred harp style was eclipsed in many areas by the musical norms of Europe, the more conventional arrangements found in the hymn books of most churches today. But traditions of shape note singing were preserved, largely by rural church communities in the South. In more recent decades, people outside of the South have again taken interest in the singing, like the West Philadelphia singers. As newcomers become exposed to the music, Elizabeth Stokes says one thing they often notice about sacred harp gatherings is that the participants sing loudly.
Sometimes not always in key, though we do strive for in key. But, I mean, there are a lot of sayings with shape note music, one famous one being said that, you know, you'll travel across the country to sing it, but you wouldn't cross the street to hear it. In many ways, a lot of people don't like the sound of shape note music.
In keeping with the original intentions of shape note music, the tradition is not about featuring polished performances by trained singers. Instead, people with little or no musical experience are encouraged to join in. They say if you can talk, you can learn to sing sacred harp. To help everyone of all skill levels stay together, many singers keep the beat by stomping a foot or rhythmically moving a hand up and down. And to aid learning the tune faster, each song commences with first singing through the shaped notes, with the corresponding fa, sol, la, or mi. There are over 500 songs in the Sacred Harp Tune Book. Though the text of some of the songs are patriotic in nature, most of them have obvious religious themes. Many of the tunes are set to words written by clergymen like Isaac Watts, Charles Wesley, and John Newton. In the view of Anna Mays, a regular of the Philadelphia Sacred Harp Group, the lyrics address topics that contemporary culture tends to avoid.
We sing a lot about death, and we sing about pain and sorrow and the traveling along life's journey and kind of what comes after life. We sing about it in a fashion that I think more reflects how those singers in generations before us were looking at those subjects, and we're more willing to maybe take it by the horns than we are today.
For some singers, like Guy Banks, a Levittown, Pennsylvania resident who often drives into Philadelphia for singings, the songs don't always settle well.
It's rather coarse, I would say, but some of it is really beautiful stuff. I may not embrace all of the poetry, but I see the beauty in it.
Banks' appreciation for the poetic nature of the songs and the traditions of sacred harp singing is shared by many. Yet others also find a deep spiritual connection to the songs. It's an expression of worship. Indeed, Anna Mays says there's an ongoing conversation among sacred harp enthusiasts. Is it spiritual music or a folk tradition?
Your answer is going to depend on who you ask.
However one labels it, sacred harp singers frequently talk about the joy of being part of an eclectic community, young and old, musically trained and untrained, religious and non-religious. Ted Stokes, who lives over an hour away from Philadelphia and has been singing sacred harp for about 15 years, says the regular meetings, conventions, and camps around the country create a special bond among the singers.
150 years ago, people had community in a totally different style than we have accessible today, and this is a return to that tight-knit community. And it transcends local geography anymore with cars, and people take planes to go to singings, you know, just because they want to be with other singers that sing this kind of music and you know, have 50 voices all blending together. And there's just a power that's there. It's hard to put a name on it. Everyone might have a different name, and it's you kind of just have to feel it.
Stokes says not feeling the music is one problem few sacred harp singers have.
Some people complain that we get a little too excited and sing too loud, and you're going to wreck your voice, as choral people tell us, you know, and that could be. I try to hold back, but it's hard sometimes not to get carried away.
The Sacred Harp meetings of West Philadelphia have only been going on for about a year, but the group continues to grow. Meanwhile, a handful of other singings regularly take place in the region, Havertown, Lancaster, Reading, and Westchester. While Sacred Harp may have taken root in and been preserved in the rural South over the past century or so, the tradition is now cropping up all over the country, bringing together ensembles of voices through the joy of singing.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. This January, Philadelphia will host the two-day Keystone Sacred Harp Convention at the Broad Street Ministry on the Avenue of the Arts in Center City. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.